radio stations have to simply stop streaming. I don't think you have to shut down your streams. I know many, many stations have done that already, both commercially and non-commercially. I don't think you have to do that. And one of the main thing, one of the main points I wanted to make today is to urge people to not shut down their streams and to continue streaming and to try to situate your station so that you can actually benefit from what's happening. The reason why I think you can benefit by what's happening is that webcasting has proven extremely popular with the public. From the time it began in 1994 and 1995 to now, it is just it has had incredible growth year after year after year. When it first started in the mid 90s, I looked at it and thought, oh well, this might be, you know, this is interesting, but who knows if this is going to end up like CB radio or ham radio or something that's really never going to pick up, that's never really going to be adopted by the public at large. But it has been adopted by the public at large. People listen to the radio on their computers. They do it at work a lot, they do it at home, but it's continued to grow. Up until very recently, the amount of people listening on a regular basis has almost been doubling every year. So from my perspective looking at it, it's almost been like the creation of a new spectrum. We had the AM band, and then we had the FM band, and I think that at the rate that it's growing, webcasting could essentially become another spectrum. So it's been growing very quickly, and people have been listening to a lot of radio on the internet. And now what's happening is because of the royalty problems, stations are ceasing their streams. The streams are getting shut down left and right. Every day for the last 2 months, there have been more and more stations shutting down their streams. And that's going to really accelerate this fall. Once the RIAA starts actually sending out bills to station, I predict that then hundreds of, when, once you get a bill and a questionnaire saying that you might owe $30,000 or even more, people are just going to shut down their streams. So as this has already been happening and as it's continued, those who remain on the web are actually picking up listeners. The companies that chart audience on the web have already noticed that foreign webcasters are already picking up a great deal of American traffic. At my station, we've continued to webcast, and our traffic has increased dramatically this summer alone. And I think that that can continue. I don't want to get any stations in legal trouble, but what I want to outline is a kind of an approach which is kind of like a civil disobedience approach to this issue. I want to quickly describe what we're doing at our station. We are making a good faith effort to negotiate with the RIAA and Sound Exchange to negotiate our own rate. The RIAA and Sound Exchange do have the legal ability to negotiate a rate with anybody, and they've negotiated lots of rates with different companies. One of the things that incenses me is that they negotiated a rate with the Corporation of Public Broadcasting to cover all NPR stations, and that rate has not been revealed. So essentially what's happened with regard to NPR stations is they are paying less. The stations that get money from the government are paying less, probably much less, than stations that do not get money from the government. But all my efforts to find out what that rate is, what the secret CPB NPR rate is, have proved fruitless. From what I've seen, it's not even subject to Freedom of Information Act. So the RIAA does have the ability to negotiate any rate it wants with anybody, and they don't have to keep to the same rate. They can license their intellectual property for anything they want with anybody. And the compulsory rates that are in question are just kind of the blanket rates that if you don't negotiate a different rate, that's what you have to pay. For non-commercial webcasters, the rate is 2/1,000ths of a dollar per listener per song, so that the more people who listen, the larger your audience gets, the more you have to pay. And then there's other little rates on top of that as well, but that's the basic rate. So anyway, we are documenting what I expect will be a fruitless effort to negotiate a rate with the RIAA. We are also approaching independent record labels that we have strong relationships with and getting them to sign waivers in which the independent record labels are essentially waiving this fee for us. It would be nice if there was a national movement of doing that, and already there have been a couple of record labels Artemis and Smile Records, two independent labels, have already announced that they are waiving webcasting fees for any radio station that wants to stream their material. We're going one step further than that and negotiating a waiver, a simple one-page waiver, with independent labels. And then perhaps one of the more difficult things for some stations is we are getting all of our DJs to document everything that they're playing on the air. Across the board, all the DJs are doing playlists. We were already well along that road, so we were lucky in that respect that we had been working on that for many years already. So I hope by this fall we will have completed the goal of having every program that uses pre-recorded music adding to our computer database exactly what they're playing. Carol?
What information are you having them log?
Right now we're having them log song title, artist title, album title, and record label. I'm not sure whether it's been announced yet what the exact reporting requirements are. They have not announced that yet. Yeah. The reporting requirements for stations that want to continue streaming when originally announced were as absurd as the rates, although they have actually, the U.S. Copyright Office actually has indicated a great deal of flexibility on the reporting requirements. They're still difficult, and I think one of the most difficult things is to simply get all of your DJs to keep playlists and to get them to keep playlists in a computer database, not to just handwrite it. When the bills come due, we are planning on immediately paying the flat rate of $500. After that, we do not plan to pay whatever rate they tell us that we are supposed to pay because we feel that we are not playing that much of their material. They are assuming that stations are playing 15 songs per hour. If you're on 24 hours a day, they are figuring 15 songs per hour. And they are just assuming that you are playing their material. Their material meaning record labels that are represented by the RIAA. Primarily the large five record companies, Universal, Sony, et cetera, BMG, et cetera, et cetera. But also a lot of other labels. There's several hundred labels that are members of the RIAA. So the assumption that the RIAA and their enforcement arm Sound Exchange are making is that you are playing 15 songs of their material per hour, and our approach is to document the fact that we are not playing anywhere near that amount, that we have these waivers with all these independent record labels. You know, here is a waiver from this label. If you look at our database, you will see that we played this many songs in a 1 week period from that record label, you know, proof that we do not owe you for that. We are also being careful to document all foreign record labels because arguably they do not have the right to collect on any material played from a non-U.S. record label, assuming that that non-U.S. record label isn't owned in part by some U.S. conglomerate. So we play a lot of material like that, and I'm sure a lot of community radio stations do. Our hope is that by simply paying the $500 fee, they will simply leave us alone, and they will be happy that we paid them something. And I think that's a possibility. It's very easy to get paranoid about this issue, but I don't think that community radio is really who the RIAA is after. They are really after the commercial webcasters, and they have already indicated that they might have some special announcement that they'll make in October about a special rate or exemption for non-commercial, non-CPB webcasters. I wouldn't get your hopes up too much on that. Anybody who's gotten their hopes up on this issue in the last couple of years has had them dashed again and again. But I think that it's possible that they will simply let small non-commercial webcasters, especially those that already are over-the-air broadcasters, go about their business. If they don't allow us to simply go about our business after paying the minimum rate of $500, we will then start providing the documentation to them that we do not owe whatever it is that they say they owe. Another thing to keep in mind about the RIAA is that they don't have any, from what we have seen so far anyway, they don't have any significant enforcement power. They are not the FCC. They do not have power over your broadcast license. They are not your licensee. They do not have power over your facilities. They are not the IRS. They do not have power over your bank accounts. They cannot go in and seize money from your bank account. They cannot disqualify your broadcast license. What they can do is sue you. And you have to ask yourself the question, are they going to sue you when you are such a small economic target already by being a community radio station? It's a lot of work for them to sue you. They will sue some people. And if we see what they've done in file sharing, they have continued to go after one target, Napster. Then they went after Audio Galaxy. Now they're going after Kazaa and other people who are, you know, more complicated people to go after. So they do tend to go after the largest economic targets. I don't think that they're after community radio in the first place. I think that if they do decide to try to enforce it, they're going to look at the community radio stations out there and realize that they don't have any amount of money to get anyway, and it's not really worth their while to go after them. It is certainly possible that somewhere down the line, they could push it all the way. But I just, for my station, we've discussed this with the station's lawyers and we've discussed it with the whole staff. We are pretty confident that we don't have to worry about getting hit with some exorbitant bill down the line. So that is the approach that we're taking and that we're quietly encouraging other community radio stations around the country to take. I think the issue of getting waivers from independent labels is just getting going. Already there are several websites that have lists of record labels and artists who are willing to waive all the fees. Another thing to bear in mind is if you have any talk programs, if you have news, talk, public affairs programming that doesn't play RIAA material, you don't have to pay for that. Again, the RIAA is assuming for news talk programming that you play one song per hour. If you simply document that it's not one of their songs and that you have a waiver from that record label, they can't collect on that hour. So some stations may have significant amounts of news talk programming, and it may be a lot easier for you to demonstrate that you don't owe them any money for news talk programming than for music programming. Bear in mind, though, that the RIAA has managed to get these rules written in such an utterly skewed fashion that it's absolutely unbelievable. You have to demonstrate to them that the music that you are playing is not their material. If you cannot prove it to them, they are entitled to collect on it. And like I said before, the rules are written in such a way where they are entitled to collect on the music that you're playing, making assumptions on how much you're playing and making the assumption that it's all theirs. They're allowed to collect on it. Then the RIAA is allowed to lop off any amount that it deems necessary to cover their own expenses for imposing this law and then for collecting on it. Then with what's left, they're allowed to keep half of what's left as their own profit, per se, and then distribute the other half to the record labels. And the only way to get around that, if you read the rules, is to demonstrate to them that you are not playing their material, which is possible. And I think that As we progress into the fall on this issue, you're going to find more and more lists online, including on my station's website. Once we have a significant list of labels, we're going to publish it. And you're going to find more and more websites that are listing record labels and artists who are waiving their fees. And then that is better documentation than nothing, that you don't owe the RIAA for that material. Right now we think it's about 50-50, but we're hoping that once we get all these waivers from the independent record labels, we're hoping that it's going to be 75% non-RIAA and 25% RIAA. And once we've done that, bear in mind that we're already a small economic target just by virtue of being a community radio station. Once we can demonstrate to them that only one-fourth of our programming is their material, we've then cut ourselves down to a quarter of our original size in terms of the size of us as an economic target, making it, I think, one-fourth likely that they're going to bother dealing with us.
Two folks coming up. First, in general, RIAA, how big are they really?
It's a trade group. It's a trade group that is primarily funded and represents the five major record labels. But for a small annual dues, a couple of $100 a year, any record label can join the RIAA. And some independent labels have joined the RIAA.
My question was basically when we talk about RIAA as a big monolithic organization, the really arm of RIAA that would be the coming after us, so to speak, how big are they? What, they're the FBI, the IRS? Or?
Yeah, it's a company called Sound Exchange. And both RIAA and Sound Exchange are not-for-profit corporations that are funded by the major record labels. And how large is Sound Exchange? I'm not sure. But I doubt that they have the ability to enforce the rule among more than a very small percentage of the U.S. radio stations that are streaming. They did write into this law, by the way. It's you know, an interesting side note. They did write into this law that Sound Exchange has the ability to send music inspectors to your radio station. They actually, like the FCC has the right to send inspectors on almost no notice to your station. Now the record companies also have the right to send music inspectors to your radio station to check on your compliance with this. Well, I doubt it's going to come to that, but it could.
And the one last thing. This is bringing up in my mind an analogy. I know how many folks remember the history of ASCAP and BMI, but BMI came about, if I understand correctly, because ASCAP's royalty fees or were so much, or the fees imposed on radio stations were so large that BMI came about simply in answer to exorbitant rates ASCAP was charging. BMI, Broadcast Music International. So then radio stations start playing only BMI license. That's just a history thought that I can't help but think about right now. Thanks.
Anybody who has questions, just come on up to the microphone so we can get them all on tape for people who are not here.
Yeah, and I also have a couple things to add about the college stations, and I can either what some of us have done in response. I can either save those, or we can take questions all at once. What's your preference?
I just asked one. Are you planning to pay the retroactive $500 for each of the years in savings?
The question is whether or not you're planning to pay the retroactive fees, which goes back to 1998. Is that right?
Yeah, we are planning on paying the fees retroactively, so we will have to come up with about $2,000 or so. Also, the rates that have been imposed so far are for the first period of this new royalty fee, which goes from October 1998, when the DMCA went into effect, to the end of 2002. So that's the first period, October 98 to December 2002. This fall, another panel is going to be convened known as a CARP, a Copyright Arbitration Royalty Panel. So the next CARP will be convened this fall to determine what rates are going to be for 2003. I think that if your station is inclined to rally listeners to contact your senators and representatives on this issue, my opinion is that the best thing to aim for is the next CARP. Congress is in recess right now. There are appeals on the table for what's currently happened, but I don't hold out much hope that they're going to change the rates that were announced on June 20th. But I think it's more possible that they could modify the rates going forward beginning next year. And there are a lot of good sites. There are some websites out there that you can direct your listeners to contact their representatives. There's one from a college station in, I can't remember, it's in the Midwest, KTRU. Yeah, KTRU has a site called Save Our Streams, and they've got a page where listeners can type in their zip code and find out who their representatives are and automatically send a fax to their representatives.
You won't be able to. My question really has to do with, I'm sure you've thought this out, but my first thought is that the idea of paying them for the 4 years is essentially bankrolling their lawyers' ability to start suing people. And the more people who pay them the 4 years' worth or the 1 year's worth, the more likely they are to have the wherewithal to go out and sue everybody or sue some people. And even if it's not us, it'll be us eventually. And so you mentioned the civil disobedience approach to this, and I'm waiting to hear what it is. Or maybe I missed it.
Well, I think that paying them the retroactive fee and documenting our attempts to negotiate a rate is all part of our attempt to prepare for a lawsuit with them. And the approach that you're implying, I think, is valid also, to simply refuse to comply whatsoever. although I think that a lot of station management might have problems with that approach. I am station management at my station, so the approach that I'm taking at my station is looking down the line for what I expect is an unlikely possibility, but you have to still take it into that it could happen, that we could get sued by the RIAA. If we get sued by the RIAA, we want to be able to show that we made a good faith attempt to negotiate a rate with them and they refused us, that we made a good faith attempt to pay a minimum rate with them, which they accepted. So, you know, and then as far as the rest of the fee, here is our documentation. We don't owe anywhere near the amount that you owe us. So that's a very defensible position. So that's why we're taking that approach.
It is, but as I point out, you're bankrolling their lawyers by sending them the money. And, you know, I don't know how to evaluate where the fine line is of what, if anything, to send them to cover your ass. But you don't really want to be paying for their lawyers as well as your own. That's not good business, right?
Yeah, that's true. But I think that it's also important to keep streaming. And I think that it's important to come up with an approach that's going to allow as many stations as possible to keep streaming. The worst thing that can happen out of this is that webcasting as a potential new spectrum is decimated, and it just falls into the hands of the five major record labels who each have their own webcasting entities to just stream their own material in an effort simply to sell their own material.
Let me just add a couple of things, and first in response to your question. You know, in principle, I don't object to paying musicians something for their work. And, you know, that's arguably what at least 40% of these fees are supposed to be doing. So that's part of the reason that you might pay. Also, not in principle, but I think probably in fact, I think they can probably afford the lawyers already, given the nature of consolidation of media ownership. I don't know that our paying or not would affect that. We're not paying anything yet. Let me just mention a couple of things, some of which Ken has raised. One of a couple points I want to clarify a little bit. One of the reasons that the CPB deal for NPR is private is because the CPB is private. It's a corporation. Although it's funded by the government, it is separated from it, so that they can do deals that are not subject to FOIA information. And, I mean, that's, we don't take CPB funds, so I can be high and mighty about this, but I think you need to think about where those funds are coming from. And one of the things that we do know about the CPB deal for the NPR stations is that CPB is paying whatever was negotiated, but only for these first 2 years or these first years until the next CARP. Another thing that I think is important to know is that the first CARPs that were called, these first series of meetings where all of this was sort of set in stone, were done entirely without representations from people like us or even other radio stations. And that's seems to be changing at this point, and there has been some responsiveness to the objections that are being raised from various sectors, including the commercial one. And a good example of that is the rollback in terms of the reporting that's going to be required. The first set of reporting regulations had something like 18 discrete bits of information that you had to provide. And a half a dozen of those were directly related to who your listeners were. That is, they were essentially are doing market research and invasive kinds of tracking for those industries. Well, those, I think, they have realized are so questionable that they have they've now withdrawn them. Or we think they have. There's nothing. There's no final anything yet. So I think. But there were things, you know, for all of us who are volunteer run, we've been doing playlists for as long as I've been at our station, but they're hand done. We don't have a database that right now that works for them. And so, you know, putting all that together would be costly for us. And those are things that we're considering right now. But let me just spend a couple minutes talking about what we did as a group of college radio stations. This was in part spearheaded by KTRU. My mind just went blank on the guy's name. Please. Will Robody. Thank you. Will Robody, who's also, I think, a vice chair of the College Broadcasters Group. And he, along with all of us from the University of California Radio Network, stations at UC campuses, which are not necessarily UC-funded. Ours is not. We collectively submitted a brief during the comments period. And we raised issues like the ways in which we're really different from commercial broadcasters. Both, I mean, we have a 40-year-old library. We don't have a playlist of 500 downloaded items or whatever it is that commercial stations are using now. So, pardon? 50? Yeah, you're quite right about that. So we were arguing essentially that all of their standards were reflective of their total ignorance of who we are, and that we were therefore asking to be excluded from the fees. We also have raised and are raising issues still about whose property, whose intellectual property we're talking about. And one of the arguments is that, you know, they're saying that when we play their song, we're using their intellectual property. And we're saying, in part, when we play their songs as part of our program, it's our intellectual property as well, okay? Because it's not something that's, you know, discrete and not part of what it's not simply what they've provided us, that there's some value added as a consequence of our programming. That they ought to be paying us. Well, fair enough. But then maybe we don't want to have their money. So, gotta be careful who you take that money from. So, it's called payola. Yes, and that's another problem altogether. I think the other thing that I wanted to raise, and I think that I'd like us to talk about some, is what we do, or do we try and do something as a concerted effort? This came up in part at the last NFCB meetings, where some people were saying, why don't we try and do something collective? And that could be anything from some collective programming to collectively distributed or created public service announcements that are educating people about this, or, you know, focus days, what have you. I don't know. I do want to say that, you know, finally, that I agree that this is new spectrum in some sense when we go to the web. But what we're doing, if we don't object to this in some fundamental way, what we are allowing is for a sort of de facto reserve of that spectrum for us. And webcasters are going to get nailed. And they are the ones, I think, who already are suffering the most. They're the ones who are shutting down and don't have other income from other sources. So if we want to think about, if we want to conceptualize it as part of an expanded, sort of democratized spectrum, then we have to say, what can we do so that other people can come in and play the game as well as us? So those are... I don't know how much I've there are probably some things regarding the college stuff that I've added. Oh, I know what I wanted to say. This is, the RIA can send inspectors or whatever they want, I guess, and I assume that they would then use that as a basis for some sort of suit. One of the problems with this for us right now, I think, is that it is also law. It is an act. And at some level, we could go to the RIA and say anything we want to, but the law is still there, and they cannot, from, you know, of their by themselves, they can't change the law. So how we strategize around that, I think in part your Ken's suggestion that we really focus on what this next round of rulemaking is going to do is a good thought. Norm.
I think, should we take this off and walk it a little bit? So I had three things I wanted to ask about. Your point, Elizabeth, about it being law, I think is, I'm going to not stand in front of the speakers, is important. The Digital Millennium Copyright Act includes in it, through the statutory license process, a bunch of programming content restrictions as well. And every time we discuss this at an NFCB or a grassroots, I raise this issue because I think that is an area where we, as community stations, could get together and fight this at the congressional level, because we're talking about what I would term a prior restraint of free speech. When they say no more than three songs by the same artist in a three-hour period, no more than four songs off a box set, that's determining program content, not just talking about money. On the money issue, we're always going to lose, because they're always going to say, oh, you're just trying to get something for nothing, and this is capitalism, and we should, you know, support the poor starving artists by letting this industry take all the money and then give them a pittance of trickle down. But I think on the free speech issue, we have a case, and I raise this again because I think we ought to all talk about how we can push that issue. And the second thing on the enforcement question that you raised, Ken, I think that what we're going to find is very much like what we're seeing in the world of WTO and GATT, that they're going to find a way to do the enforcement through talking about free trade, through talking about economic benefits and so on. And so we just need to be prepared for that and not assume that just because they're not the IRS or the FCC, they won't have a way of enforcing this. And then the final thing I wanted to raise, I don't know how many stations report to CMJ, the College Music Journal. CMJ has a new scheme that they're developing right now, which is going to, they say it's going to make it much easier for stations to do their reporting. What they're going to do is they're going to put a computer in stations which will listen to your audio stream, sample the songs, compare them against a database based on musical signatures that they've created in this database, and they'll be able to automatically generate playlists. And that gives them, A, the ability to check and see if the reporting that you're doing matches what you're actually playing, and B, it's a whole nother possibility for monitoring enforcement for this for these RIAA fees, although they're not saying that. They're saying it's going to be private. But this will be a database that will be continually growing and that will develop based on the stations that participate, because as they sample your streams, if the songs don't match the musical signatures in their database, they go back and ask you for the playlist, and then they add those songs to the database.
Can I just one comment about that. It's called digital fingerprinting. Wonderful concept. We need more fingerprinting, I think, in our society, generally speaking. About 5 years ago, but maybe it's longer than that, I lose track of time, CMJ started encouraging people to report to them by computer, via the web. Now you're required to report that way if you're reporting to CMJ. And so it's what they're doing is they're using this as an inducement with targeted stations at this point. They offer you the computer and the software, and all you have to do is install it, and, you know, it just makes your life easy. Well, it's going to make everybody's life required, quite likely, a few years down the road. And CMJ used to be one of those bastions of independent music. And I don't know who owns it now, but a few years ago it was bought by a corporation in England somewhere. And I heard they have sold it again, but I don't know about that. So, I mean, we need to keep checking what we mean by indie anything, I think. Frida?
I apologize for being late, and I wonder, you might possibly have covered this, but it has to do with the violations on the internet with the streaming. I mean, does this apply only to servers in the U.S., or, I mean, who is really responsible at the long run? I mean, what if you stream to a server in Costa Rica or something?
I don't have the answer to that question, except that I've had inquiries, I know, from Canada and from England about this, because they're concerned, presuming that however we go on this, so will they in another year or two.
Yeah, I know a little bit about that, and the RIAA has indicated that they're going to go after people who try to place servers offshore in Canada or Mexico, and there's already streaming service providers in Canada who are trying to capitalize on this and pick up business. But if you have to do a stream, you need an encoder and a server. If the encoder is in the U.S., the RIAA is not going to buy the view that the stream is coming from Canada, you know.
There's a reference on that thing somewhere to ephemeral streams. It took me a while to figure out what an ephemeral stream was, but that's basically that encoder. Or if you were sending something on your side channels that's not broadcast, in fact, but somehow has been digitized, that's considered something else that you were supposed to also be paying fees on. One other thing that I'm not sure about that I wanted to ask, because Ken may have a better or Carol may have a better response for this, better idea of this, is at the NFCB conference, we were talking about the language in this stuff, which refers to digitized programming. And one of the things that we are afraid that we might also get nailed with down the road is that at such time, if we go to a digitized broadcast, then that might also then be subject to the rules under the CARP because it's digitized sound. And I'm not sure the lawyers at NFCB, at the NFCB conference, said that was something to be wary about. They didn't have an answer to that. Do you?
No, I don't have an answer to that. But we'll be talking about, I'm on a workshop this afternoon about digital audio broadcasting and in-band on channel, which is the plan for FM digital broadcasting. But I think what you said before is absolutely correct, that in a way this webcasting royalty battle is the first battle of what's going to become a major, major issue in the next 10 or 20 years, because the FCC is beginning to move very, very fast now in digital broadcasting. Just yesterday, the FCC announced that by 2007, all television sets have to have a digital tuner in them. And things are moving very fast on digital FM, although there hasn't been much talk about it yet. This fall, the FCC is most likely going to approve this terrible plan called in-band on channel for FM digital broadcasting. And the FCC appears to be, and then there's something else called the Spectrum, the Spectrum Trust, or the FCC is really beginning to take a thorough look at AM and FM in general and the future of digital broadcasting, and they're really trying to prepare for digital broadcasting. And it would appear at the present moment that the FCC is getting ready to really move the U.S. towards digital broadcasting much, much faster than it's been going so far. And as we move towards digital broadcasting, these copyright questions are probably going to be present in every form of digital broadcasting. In other ways as well. This afternoon, I'll be talking about digital audio broadcasting, and as an example of the kinds of things the FCC has in mind for us, if in-band on channel is accepted and radio stations start digitizing their signals, you're going to have to pay a royalty to a company called Ubiquiti just for broadcasting. Like, currently, you have your transmitter. You don't have to pay anybody a royalty for turning your transmitter on. Under digital broadcasting, you may have to actually pay a royalty to a company for turning your digital transmitter. The FCC is essentially granting Ubiquiti a monopoly. And Ubiquiti is owned by, of course, all the clear channels and the equipment manufacturers. So this issue of royalty payment, copyright ownership, intellectual property, which has not been present in our lives up to this point, is just going to become a bigger and bigger issue.
About
okay.
10 feet here.
Okay. Another thing is about copyright, because there's all this alternative copyright thing that's come out of Harvard and some other places. I'm wondering about what kind of relationship or organization might be set up between non-commercial radio stations and people in the music industry who want to have a different kind of copyright or a completely different copyright arrangement that bypasses these big companies.
I think that's one of the places that we could do some organizing. There are people like Janice Ian who, did you send out her article? I've gotten it several times by now. She did a long piece. Pardon? So there are a number of artists who are saying, we don't need this. This is not hurting us. In fact, it's helping us. And so I think when we begin to talk about how we might, if we wanted to do something collectively, whatever we're doing at our individual sites, we should definitely reach beyond radio and beyond community radio.
I'm sorry I was late. You may have explained this already, but the CPB relationship to royalty payments, I know that is one thing that keeps stations. Certainly at Pacifica, producers are not objecting to CPB funds because it covers their royalty, music royalties. Could you explain that relationship? It's outside of NPR. Do you know about it? And the other thing is purely technical. If you play part of a song, does that count as playing the whole song? How do they charge for that?
I can only guess at the last one, and I would assume they'd charge you as though you'd played the whole thing, but I don't know. How many minutes worth? Based on how many minutes worth? Do you want to speak to the CPB thing?
The Corporation for Public Broadcasting negotiates on behalf of not NPR stations, but all CPB-qualified stations, to pay their broadcast royalties and now their webcast royalties. And there actually isn't a rate because the stations don't pay. There's just a lump sum that's based on an estimate of how many stations there are and what kind of streaming they're doing and that sort of thing. but it is secret, and, you know, if you have a station that's willing to share it with you, you can figure out what it is. I mean, one of the most important things about their agreement, I think, is that for stations that have fewer than 10 employees, they're exempted from the reporting requirements entirely. And so that's one of the things. NFCB has had some discussions with RIAA and the Sound Exchange, along with the college broadcasters, to try to come up with a rate. They were very anxious to do this around the time of the NFCB conference and have become less anxious to do this since then. But we were proposing for non-commercial broadcasters basically like a $250 a year rate and no reporting requirements for stations with fewer than 10 employees. And they seemed to be being receptive to it at the time. And then as things took off and the Copyright Office came out with their ruling, the discussions have sort of stopped, but we're hoping to get them going again.
Well, probably like a lot of you, this stuff really burns me up. And it especially burns me up because these people are pretending, like playing their music on our radio stations, that they're doing us a favor. So I would like to call their bluff on that. I don't know how we could get everyone to agree. Let us not play a single piece of copyrighted music on any of our stations. Now, I'm a public affairs broadcaster, so I don't actually care about the music myself, you know. Well, so let me just like put that on there. I mean, you know, we do play music, but there's a lot of local artists. There's, you know, like a lot of, you know, radical musicians that are not signed with record companies. Let's promote the hell out of these people on our radio stations, and let's not play anyone that's signed, and let's make a statement that because of this, we're not playing your music and we're not putting it on our web streams. Okay, I'm serious. Let's see what happens then. You want some action fast? I think we're going to see some action fast. Clamoring for them to get that stuff out of there. Yeah, they think they're doing us a big favor to let us play their music. I don't think so.
There's actually a site. There's already a site called Boycott RIAA. I can't remember the exact web address, but if you go to a search engine and just type in Boycott RIAA, there is a site based around the very idea of boycotting all our RIAA material. And another thing you kind of got at there is that there are other types of programming that are not subject to these fees. Live music is not subject to these fees. even tapes of live music from your own radio station. Remember, all we're talking about are recordings that came out on a record label. So stations can share live recordings with each other. A lot of stations put out tapes and CDs of live music from their stations. So that's another way around it. And also the Boycott RIAA site does have a list of all the record labels and the sub-labels, because a lot of times, you know, Universal has dozens and dozens of labels under its umbrella. It's not always so easy to see who you're talking about. One other thing, don't assume that if an independent label is a member of the RIAA, don't assume that they are the enemy. There are some labels that belong to the RIAA that have actually waived webcasting fees. I can think of one like that, Tim Kerr. The label Tim Kerr has done that, and probably more and more will. And I think in the coming months you're going to see more and more labels and artists who are saying that radio stations have their permission to webcast their material. And if there's anything good that can come out of this, actually, I think it might be a real bifurcation in the whole music scene, where there's going to be labels and artists who have a forward-looking approach to this, who are saying it's okay to webcast our material, and labels who are being really backwards about it. And you can already see that there are a lot of record labels that have joined some of the more interesting commercial file sharing sites like eMusic.com. eMusic.com is a commercial file sharing site that allows people to basically get unlimited downloads. For $10 a month, you can download as many albums in their entirety as you want. And there's a lot of commercial record labels that have joined eMusic.com. So I think that as this issue goes forward, there's kind of going to be a line drawn in the sand, and labels and artists are going to really have to decide which side they're on. And it's going to become easier and easier to tell whose material you might get charged for and whose material you are allowed to stream.
I got a question. Can you just reiterate, because you had said something about at least what the legal law is right now, is that you have to keep track of all the tracks you play, and that if you don't, that even ones that aren't, say, covered under this RIA agreement, you could be potentially charged for. So, for example, really quickly, like BIX, we basically are going to do, for example, we're taping this, we're going to air it, some of the events we're streaming, but then some of us want to help also incorporate culture, because otherwise the public affairs stuff is talk, talk, talk. So even just playing one song, we try to do independent artists, but does that mean we should be, whether one agrees or disagrees with it, that we should be keeping track of whenever we play that? And does this affect talk, or it's only music?
For talk and news programming, the rules say that they just assume that you're playing one RIAA song per hour. So that's the assumption they make. The RIAA also has the legal right to collect this royalty for non-RIAA labels. They're not only collecting for themselves, they actually have deputized themselves to collect it on behalf of everybody. So you're not off the hook. You're not off the hook by playing if you go to this Boycott the RIAA website, there's all the labels, and you say, okay, we just won't play any of those labels. You're not off the hook yet. You can avoid playing RIAA labels. The RIAA still has the legal right to collect and supposedly distribute money to those labels. The way to get out of it is you have to have a waiver from that label. But it's going to become easier and easier, I think, because it's already getting going. In the last week, two labels have made these big announcements that webcasters can use our material. And there's going to be more and more announcements like that. And there's also going to be I think more and more stations who are taking the approach we're taking at WFMU, negotiating our own contracts with independent record labels who we have an ongoing relationship with. So it's going to be easier and easier for you to document the fact that you're playing material that is not subject to the RIAA, but there has to be, the record label has to say that somewhere. And also, I don't think that it's necessary. I don't think you should feel like you have to have all your DJs keep a playlist in a computer database. I think if all you can manage to do is have people handwrite it, then that's what you should do. It's the station's duty to report to the RIAA. The RIAA can say all at once, like, you have to submit it in this way. But if you send them, you know, 10,000 handwritten playlist pages, what are they going to do? Ship it back to you? You know, so you should keep the information in any way that you can. You shouldn't feel like you have to do it exactly the way the RIAA is going to tell you that you have to do it.
Just one maybe challenged everybody coming off Lynn's suggestion. Maybe by the end of these meetings, we would like to develop a statement that we could use, that GRC stations could use, maybe to send out to independent labels, certainly for a positive kind of action, but also to see about developing something for a more onerous ones. My fear is that we'd all do that. I mean, stations like mine play so little of the music that they're interested in that I kind of feel like they could blow us off because we're not bringing in the money anyway. But I'm certainly prepared to talk about it. We've got one. Do you want to be a question?
Somewhere in between that suggestion about not playing any, you know, and any copyrighted material, and then what Ken was saying about the bifurcation of the music industry, it led me to think. I'm like, I have a music program, and I was thinking, I don't know how I would get by without playing something that's copyrighted in some way. And it also made me think along the lines of between webcasting and file sharing and just new ways that music gets exchanged as part of a cultural heritage. Is there's sort of this move in a different direction than we're used to, but definitely than the record industry's used to, and having identifiable, you have an artist and a whole label, and the music gets distributed, and like what you were saying about, you can never win, arguing against the capitalist argument. Within that, I see an argument that like what the RIAA and these record labels are doing is they're kind of going against their own capitalist rules, and that they're not following where the market's going, where the people in the market have kind of spoken, or at least, especially for really young people, they're into the computers, is that they're kind of speaking, this is the way we want to exchange information and ideas. So I don't really have a question. That's just kind of a suggestion I have. And then based on that also is, who is speaking on behalf of the people? If the FCC is not acting as a government body to kind of protect these avenues, if they're actually just pushing through technologies for corporations, and if large corporations can have these large lobbying bodies, then where exactly do the people have a say? And that's the other suggestion or question I have.
To your last question, I don't know.
It's hard to follow up that point. I just wanted to know, how is there a website, or how do you find out, which label is announcing what and how it's negotiated, or the stations or waived their rights, or how do you find out about this?
Unfortunately, there isn't one centralized location yet. At my station, we just sent out our first wave of waivers. To record labels, to 10 record labels who we knew really well, and we wanted their feedback on it, and we're getting them to it. They're agreeing to it, although we're making modifications to the waiver. I expect that probably by a month from now, my website will have this up on our, we'll have a link to it on our homepage at wfmu.org. There's a good page called saveinternetradio.org, that has kind of been central to the effort to preserve webcasting. And from an activism viewpoint, what's been happening, I feel like the whole campaign to fight this really got the wind kicked out of it on June 20th, because what happened was on May 21st, there was a big announcement, and the U.S. Copyright Office rejected the proposals that were on the table. They just rejected them outright, which was very unusual for the U.S. Copyright Office to just outright reject its own proposals. So at that point, on May 21st, when that happened, I think everybody who was fighting this declared victory. There was a lot of press attention on this issue prior to May 21st, and a lot of stations were rallying their listeners to write their congressmen and representatives about it. And I know that my station's listeners told me that when they called their congressmen, the people who answered the phone said, like, oh, this is the 20th call I've gotten today about this issue. I mean, I think that people really were reaching out to their representatives. And then on May 21st, the U.S. Copyright Office rejected its very own proposals, and everybody declared victory. And they said, by the way, we'll make it final on June 20th. And on June 20th, they basically reaccepted the same proposals that they had rejected, with very few minor modifications. And at that point, from my vantage point, the whole movement to fight this has just gotten the wind kicked out of it. There's no longer a central place that's doing it. These people in Chicago who do the SaveInternetRadio.org site get a lot of really good information out there, but they are no longer really doing the rallying cry. I think that's why it's important for stations to come up with their own approach for being able to continue webcasting on into the future. And I do think that this fall, community stations should try to all band together and rally their listeners to contact their congresspeople again when the new panel is convened, which is going to determine what the rates are going forward.
I didn't mean to be flippant about your question about who does represent us. The FCC clearly doesn't, with particularly under its current leadership. But I think we represent us, and that's important. So
the FCC is only just now beginning to get involved in this issue, and only because digital television is really coming up fast. So they just in the last couple of days have started to announce what their intentions are regarding copyright control on digital television and whether or not there's going to be a broadcast flag that'll prevent programs and material from being copied on a digital broadcast platform.
Hey, thanks for the session. Little tiny questions. Are webcasters considered their own category of broadcasters now? If you have a radio station and a webcast, do you fall in now two categories? Just kind of simple little...
Yeah, over-the-air broadcasters...
Come on over here, buddy.
They consider over-the-air broadcasters with streams to be one category. They consider commercial broadcasters who... Yeah, they have different categories of webcasters. So they have people who webcast only with no radio station at all on a commercial basis. They have people who do the same thing on a non-commercial basis. So they have like...
It's all worked out. Okay.
Yeah.
And then the other thing was perhaps it'd be a good idea from this point forward, just a suggestion that, you know, every community station who's interested in, you know, picking up where the Chicago people left off and putting some air back into... The idea is make these, you know, 3-minute PSAs to educate the public about where we all stand on this individually. Upload them to, you know, indie media sites for everyone to download and integrate. So there's a unity heard throughout the entire grassroots radio network of, okay, yeah, those folks in Connecticut are saying the same thing and they have this take on it. And this is why, I mean, just the action.
I actually like that idea a lot, except 3 minutes is way too long for my listeners. They have a hard time with 3-minute songs, let alone 3-minute speeches. So, you know, let's make 3 1-minute ones and put it on once an hour, but whatever. But I really like the idea, and I think it's one of the best ideas that I've heard this morning, is the idea of developing some uniform PSAs that inform our listeners and urge them to get involved in protecting our web stream and in questioning the way in which the FCC is being administered under the current government and in whose interest.
On that note, and I'm sorry, I don't have the right information. I know that our station did get a set of packaged PSAs. I don't know who produced them, but there were PSAs out there. Now I can't tell you where we got them.
Well, I think one of the challenges is to come up with a unified strategy and something like that. And I think that we'll have the more of us who are working together on this, the stronger we're going to be in terms of having an impact. And I think that community stations and college stations are a really natural group of allies to work together on this. And if we can come up with a strategy that will bring together the public, I think one of the issues that needs to be addressed is the whole issue of whether, I mean, on the broadcast side, we have not paid artists and labels ever. And that's unique to the United States. In the rest of the world, radio stations do pay some money to artists. My understanding is that one of the only good things about the whole RIAA agreement is that the artists were able to get a specification that 45% of the payment would go directly to the artists, not through the record labels, who, you know, have all of these ways of the artists owe forever what they do and never get any of the money from publishers and things like that. And that's one thing in the agreement that is good, and I think we need to decide if we're going to take a position that we don't want artists to get any money from the radio stations, or whether we want to come up with some kind of strategy that would, in a reasonable way, compensate artists for the music that's played.
I agree that I think that artists are entitled to something, but it should probably be in line with what radio stations are already paying. And if you look at your regulatory structure for your radio station, what are you paying ASCAP, BMI, and CSAC? My station is paying about $2,500 a year to ASCAP, BMI, and CSAC. The RIAA is asking us to pay like, you know, $60,000 a year. What do we pay the FCC for applications? Well, most non-commercial FM applications, there's no fee at all. They're waived. So, you know, it should be in line with that, I think. In terms of getting your listeners to contact your Congress people this fall when the new panel is convened to decide the rates 2003 and forward, I think that you should encourage your listeners to make phone calls to your Congress people and to fax them, as opposed to just emailing a template or even faxing them a template. Urge your listeners to actually make a heartfelt individual appeal to them, which carries a lot more weight than just sending in a cookie cutter announcement that they cut and pasted from a website somewhere. And also, I think that a very strong argument could be made for community radio, that community radio stations that are non-CPB get no money from the government, and yet they are being asked to pay more, probably much more, than the CPB qualified stations that do get money from the government. And I think that's an argument that Democratic and Republican representatives can understand. It really makes no sense. It's lacking in any kind of basic fairness at all that the RIAA cut this deal with CPB and completely left non-commercial, non-CPB stations out of the loop.
In listening to all of this, all these ideas have been spinning around in my head. And one of the things that that it might be effective in terms of unity is there's a big satellite up in the sky. It's called the Public Radio Satellite. And that satellite system could possibly be utilized to put together a 1 or 2 hour special that can be distributed on CD for community stations, as well as the rest of the public radio audience is out there, because obviously this is affecting not just us, but it's going to affect a lot of people. The concepts of Paul getting a hold of Janice, maybe doing some sort of live concert thing, some sort of benefit, something to raise an awareness and collectively get together and put our heads together and figure out how do we build that, how do we promote that, how do we get that out there. And it's just a kind of a thought that I had that, you know, I mean, the music speaks, the people speak, and that's what we are, so we should really use that. And we have all the tools we need to make it heard, I think. So just some thoughts.
There's also a infos that we could post to. We don't, for those of us who don't have that satellite connection. Yes.
Whoop. Just a important point of clarification. The public radio satellite is just one channel that is leased from a satellite that's actually called Galaxy 6, which is owned by the Pan Am Sat Satellite Corporation. So we have only very little bit of access to that. The Pacifica satellite, which is GE1, where Pacifica leases a space, is a lot cheaper. And somebody mentioned yesterday the idea of distributing more programming on the KU band. And I think that's also a good method. Plus, of course, AINFOS and the internet and all the other ways that we distribute programs.
You know, the thing that we really didn't address is, and this is part of what Carol was raising about whether or not it's fair for artists to be paid. The reason we've never had to pay fees to artists is that there was always that fundamental presumption that our playing artists was beneficial to them, that it sold music for them. And that's one of the, sorry, one of the useful things about Janice Ian's letter is she sort of anecdotally says, you know, we still make money, we still sell product or our music, not product, as a consequence of webcasting. So that the fundamental argument that the RIAA is making is a fallacious one, that they're still making money, they're still selling music. And I think, you know, the other thing that nobody ever raises is that very often the same people that have the music businesses have as well the equipment that we're downloading stuff from, Sony, you know. They're making money in more than one way, and we need to not let them pretend that the only, you know, that music companies are somehow discrete from all of their other businesses. Yes.
I know this is a naive legal question, but how vulnerable would artists be if they got together forming some entity that would refuse or acknowledge that we don't need royalties from any sort of broadcasting, just from the sale of our music? I mean, is there some sort of way of organizing the artists themselves who would not even require payments at all from us?
I think there probably is, but I can tell you the experience that we've had in trying to get waivers from labels so far is that, first of all, a musician who is just getting going will agree to anything. The really problem is getting labels and artists who have careers and are making some money already, getting them to agree to it. And even independent labels who we're, my station is very friendly with, have had some reservations about signing the waiver from us. Primarily one point in the waiver form that we've now modified, which said that they're waiving the webcasting royalty for us past, present, and future. They had a bit of problem with that because they're from a small independent record label's point of view, maybe someday they're going to want to sign an artist and the artist might not agree to that. So they wanted to have some out. Likewise, I think artists might have some problem agreeing to just forego royalties forever without being able to, without understanding, you know, exactly where the limitations are on that. So I think that labels and artists who agree with the whole idea in principle, if they're working artists and record labels who are making careers out of it, they're going to have concerns that you're going to need to address. The way we've addressed it in our record label waiver is we're saying that the label is agreeing to waive the royalty fee for our radio station, but anytime they want to get out of this agreement, they just need to tell us or just give it to us in writing and they're out of the agreement.
Could you provide us with a copy of the waiver, the letter you're sending?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. I don't have it with me, but I'd be happy to email it to anybody. You can just email me at ken@wfmu.org. And I'll email you our waiver. And once we have about 10 or 20 labels who've agreed to it, we're going to put up a page about it and keep a running list of the labels. But that's probably at least a month off. But for now, you can email me, ken@wfmu.org.
Maybe we could post it to the GRC and the NFCB listserv. Also, if you can post, you know, stuff to the SOS website, I think that would be, I mean, that seems like kind of the best collective place right now.
This may sound like a more vehement kind of reverse psychology, not even reverse psychology, more vehement approach here is simply telling artists, hey, if there is no waiver, we're not going to play you. Maybe that's inherent in what we're doing, but it's almost like maybe I'm too angry this morning because I want to put it to people. Look, either you sign a waiver or we simply won't play you. You know, I'm getting too angry. Never mind.
I just, one thing that I have to say when we talk about not playing anybody, first of all, to say you're not going to play anything that's copyrighted, copyright, you don't have to go out and get a copyright. Things that are produced in a certain kind of way are automatically copyrighted. So you can't use that as a measure. But secondly, you know, we were talking about how difficult it is to get your people to do playlists. For me to figure out you know, out of the thousands and thousands of pieces of music that we have in our station, which one belongs to who, especially since most of the people, the independents have been gobbled up by bigger corporations, is like a nightmare. I mean, just to think about trying to figure out who those are. I think that's one reason why I go for a kind of positive spin to say, to get artists, to get labels, to get whomever, to say, we're opting out of this and you can play us. But that's just because, I mean, when you're relying on volunteers, who I dearly love, I also know that they can be, you know, kind of sometimes as reliable as rotten rope. So.
Just to return to the idea of consciousness raising on this issue and maybe PSAs and producing some kind of programming, I just had an idea that, you know, rather than putting something together that might be an hour in length or 2 hours in length or whatever, if we could produce some modules that maybe could fit into the max window in a local cutaway on an ATC feed or a morning edition, The World or something like that, where we could promote that to stations that do those and try to target the message to, the greatest number of people, during the highest listening times. That's all.
I also wanted to add something that in terms of, because we're going to leave here and people are still going to talk about this, one of the things that I would like to see defined more, because everybody's kind of got it's something that it is an issue that hasn't come to the fore a lot, and a lot of us aren't clear on just what the nature of copywriting is and what it means. And I don't know if Carol's going to talk about this later in one of her workshops, but this idea of copywriting being a kind of lease on the public good, like if you have a government, because you have a society and people are working together as a society for the collective good of the people. It's kind of somewhere in there. There's that idea of that's why there's a government. That the copyrights then is like for a certain time people are allowed because they're the ones that created it to have control over that. But then it returns to the public domain to enrich the society because, how do you grow? And again, it's like I said, if you can argue this within the capitalist system, how do you grow if you don't have a free exchange of ideas, if everything's being controlled and copyrighted, where do the ideas get exchanged? So I don't know if Carol, you can, is that an accurate way to look at copywriting?
Well, you are doing a workshop on this too. Yeah.
Well, not exactly. I'm doing a workshop on sort of legal, legislative, and regulatory updates that are going on, but I think this issue is a really interesting one at this point, and that new technologies are demanding that we think about these things in an all new way. I mean, copyright. My understanding about copyright is that it actually doesn't allow you to control how it's used or who uses it, but it compensates you for sort of having done the creative work to develop it, and for a certain period of time you're entitled to that. But in fact, if you pay for the rights to use a piece of music or something like this, I mean, I know this from the recording side of things, they actually can't, if it's ever been recorded at all, they can't tell you that you can't record it or can't use it. You have the rights, so it doesn't limit access to it. It just provides compensation, is my understanding.
There's an excellent book that's just come out called Copyrights and Copy Wrongs by a guy named Siva Vaidyanathan, who is in Madison now, working at the library school, and it speaks. Oh, okay. He speaks directly to the issues as you raise them. What's happening, and it's happening more under WTO and the sort of globalization that's going on, is they're extending the range of that copyright. And there was a change in the copyright law they called the Sonny Bono Copyright Act, which was for the in honor of the wonderful musician Sonny Bono. That they've extended the life of copyright now to, I think it's 70 years beyond the life of the artist or something like that. So it's becoming more and more a restrictive control on the works rather than what you were suggesting, which is some way that the work can contribute to.
I just have one last thing to say. I don't know how much time we've got. We've got a few minutes, I think. But I was going to ask whether there's a group of people, a small group, who want to try and craft something that maybe we would then present at the final meeting for GRC to sign on to. You do? Anybody else? Carol? Ken? Anybody else? You want to meet right after this? How about at lunch? Meet at lunch? Anybody that's interested in this?
I just wanted to say a couple of quick things. There's another really great book that gets onto a lot of these issues called The Future of Ideas by Lawrence Lessig, who's a Stanford University law professor. Bear in mind that lost in a lot of the discussions about webcasting is the fact that webcasting and file sharing are not the same thing at all. And the RIAA is extremely upset about the endless digital distribution of their material. And it's very easy for webcasters to encode their streams such that it's fairly difficult for people to capture those streams or record them onto their computer. And it's even easier for stations to serve archived programming in such a way that it cannot be captured. But a lot of people don't understand this fact, and it gets lost on every end of this argument that file sharing is one thing, webcasting is something else. They are not the same thing. Webcasters do not have to be making copies of the material that they're webcasting available to people. They can simply listen to it on their computer. They don't have to be able to capture it. And that's really not what people want from webcasting. People aren't listening to webcasts so that they can record the webcast and then sit there and divide every song into its own little computer file and then upload it to Audio Galaxy. That's not what's happening. But the RIAA seems to think that that is what's happening. What's happening is people are using their computer as a radio. They're listening to it. They're almost never recording it. So that fact gets lost. One of the things that Lawrence Lessig talks about in his book, The Future of Ideas, also is the fact that going forward, with digital platforms such as the internet, we're going to see more and more restrictions placed on those platforms specifically to protect intellectual property. That has not happened. That has not happened on AM or FM. It doesn't happen on lots of other platforms. For example, another platform is the U.S. An analogy he uses is the U.S. highway system. The U.S. highway system is not built so that you cannot speed on a road. The telephone system is not built so that you cannot make a threatening, so that you cannot threaten to kill somebody over the telephone. Yet they are trying to build the internet, and they're going to be trying to build digital broadcasting platforms such that you cannot do anything illegal with intellectual property. And they're going to be trying to be placing all these impediments in the way. And this is something that's just getting going. And we'll be talking more about that this afternoon, in this room at 1:30 during the digital broadcasting session.
I was just going to ask about parallel digital systems, because before there was the World Wide Web, I mean, there was FidoNet and all these kinds of things, and I know that there's like open source movement and stuff like that. I mean, is there in fact a parallel internet on which we could do completely different things and not have the speed traps or whatever is on the industry one?
Well, unfortunately, I think that there is no parallel internet, and as the internet moves along, it's falling more and more under corporate control, sorry to say, although there are open source movements within it. I think, you know, going forward, as if more and more copyright protections are implemented, you're going to be better off with an open source operating system like Linux, you know, as opposed to Microsoft. But there is no other alternate World Wide Web for webcasting over. There's tons of small networks, and there could be things like that in the future. And you know, there's all sorts of exciting possibilities in the future. A frequency called ultra wideband that opens up all sorts of amazing possibilities, but we're not there yet.
Well, the internet's getting better. It was originally controlled by the military. Ken had said, open source operating systems, but specifically the choice of encoding software and decoding software that you use will end up affecting how corporations are able to regulate and keep track of the information you use. So by default, when your station decides to use Microsoft servers and Microsoft Winamp players, you are making it much easier for corporations to regulate and keep track of what you're doing. So I would suggest, I know it can sometimes be a little bit more difficult to get going, but you investigate open source options for your servers if you are going to get up an encoding stream.
Yeah, and we'll be talking more specifics about that actually this afternoon. I can't remember the exact time. I'm working on a nuts and bolts of webcasting panel. We'll talk about more practical applications about how to actually do it and different ways of doing it and things like that.
I think we're just about out of time. One more quick question.
Has anybody, or has this already been done? Is there a way of documenting a case that actually these people are making money off of us? They're not losing money? That's legally documented. We could prove it once and for all that that's what's happening.
There's actually a couple different sets of surveys that were done about Napster. And I think there's some fairly convincing evidence that shows that Napster increased sales in record stores of CDs. Although the record industry argues using other data that it did not. But.
Statistics are marvelous, aren't they?
Yeah.
I just want to thank you all for your interest, and but also to say in anticipation for your activism on this stuff. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, everybody. Keep streaming. Keep your streams on.
Improvements that are possible, like multicasting, that aren't being adopted.